You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 22nd of July 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme, we'll discuss whether Egypt still has a role in solving the Gaza conflict. Plus, we'll be hearing from the DJ's DJ, Bill Brewster, who stopped by at Monocle to tell us why he's slowing down the groove.
The idea is to create an atmosphere with music that would be played somewhere beyond 2 a.m. in the morning. If you just suddenly stop it and change to a much slower tempo, people will notice, and you do get people coming up and saying, "Can you switch it up a bit, mate?"
And our Spain correspondent explains why one university in the country is passing the Catholic Church its own collection basket.
There's been some incredible scenes inside the Complutense University in Madrid of priests staging masses and confessionary kind of sittings in the corridors in their kind of very kind of particularly Catholic way of protesting.
All that and plenty more besides coming up right here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. So lots ahead in the next hour here on the show. Before we begin, though, let's get the latest news from around the world.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Paul Osborne. A renewed diplomatic effort to end the violence in Gaza is underway. But as talks continue, so does that violence, with more than 600 Palestinians and 30 Israelis killed in the 2 weeks since airstrikes on Gaza began. The US Secretary of State John Kerry has been discussing a possible peace plan with Egypt, and UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has met Israel's Prime Minister. Benjamin Netanyahu insisted that Hamas, and not Israel, is to blame for civilian deaths.
We have made every effort and will continue to make every effort to avoid civilian casualties. We are targeting Hamas terrorist targets, embedded in civilian areas, embedded in mosques, embedded in hospitals, embedded in an agricultural school.
The American airline Delta says it's cancelling all flights to Israel indefinitely after reports of rocket fire near to Tel Aviv's airport. But White House spokesman Josh Earnest says there is no official warning to avoid the area's airspace.
It's my understanding that the FAA has not issued any notices related to the ongoing violence in that region of the world. I do think this does serve to illustrate, though, that it's individual carriers who make the decision about their flight plans and whether or not to alter specific routes based on hostilities.
The victims of the plane crash over Ukraine have now been removed from rebel-held territory. Remains of those killed in the loss of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 will be flown to the Netherlands. Russia continues to dismiss Western claims that the plane was shot down by rebels. International monitors earlier claimed that parts of the plane's wreckage had been tampered with. Alexander Hoog is part of the OSCE observer mission in the region.
The work now here will continue by experts, both on the accident scene but also where the bodies are now. And the OSCE will remain in the area. However, the OSCE's task to monitor remains as valid here as elsewhere in Ukraine.
Joko Widodo will be the next president of Indonesia. Official results from elections earlier this month show he won 53% of the vote. His rival, former General Prabowo Subianto, had threatened to challenge the results, citing electoral fraud, but now says he's accepted that he's been defeated. The widow of the Russian dissident Alexander Litvinenko says she is relieved and delighted by news that the British government is to stage a public inquiry into his death. It's 8 years since the former KGB officer died in a hospital in London after being poisoned with the radioactive element polonium. The inquiry will look at claims that Russia was involved in his death. Marina Litvinenko has told a news conference the truth will out in the end. Aid agencies in South Sudan say the country may be facing Africa's worst famine in decades. Just 3 years after the nation won independence from Sudan, food stocks are running low and crops are failing. There are reports of a huge number of emaciated children arriving at emergency feeding centres. Daniel Chut lives in the town of Lier and says conditions are getting worse every day.
People are suffering from hungry, there's no water, there are diseases. And I can see NGOs are still coming, so I'm hoping for the good things to happen here in the area.
The White House says it will appeal against a U.S. appeal court decision striking down key parts of President Obama's health care reforms. It means some people in more than 30 states would not be eligible for help. The legal challenge was one of a series mounted by opponents of the legislation. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. There'll be more news from Paul Osborne at the bottom of the hour. Right now, though, at 5 minutes past, you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and we'll be back right after this.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Op London, du er Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette er Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London, Europa.
Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London. London.
This is Monocle 24.
You're with Midori House. The time here in London is 18.06, 13.06 in New York City. Well, joining me now with their take on some of the day's news here in the studio are both Samira Shackle and James Schneider. Welcome back to the programme, both of you. We start, as so often we have in the past few weeks, in Gaza. Or to be more specific, in Egypt, which is where the US Secretary of State John Kerry is now desperately trying for a second time to broker a ceasefire, and where UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has urged Israel and the Palestinians to stop fighting and start talking. The death toll, as we're hearing in the news, is over 600. Many of those killed were women and children, and 30 Israelis, including at least 27 soldiers, are known to have died in the conflict. Kerry today announced the US will send $47 million of aid to help alleviate suffering in Gaza, adding,
Meanwhile, we will work to see if there is some way to not only arrive at a ceasefire of some kind, but to get to a discussion about the underlying issues.
And one of those other underlying problems the USA will be tackling now, and one that perhaps gives greater impetus to them to find a solution, is the news that the Federal Aviation Administration has suspended flights for a period of time into Israel's Ben Gurion airport. They're prohibited flying into Tel Aviv for 24 hours. Samira, we've heard Barack Obama talking about a ceasefire. It should be based on the one agreed back in 2012. Kerry's being slightly more nebulous, but we've got these other impetus on them to try and drive through a result. What do you think the deal, if there is to be one, could or perhaps should look like?
It's difficult to say. I mean, as you say, the sort of international leaders are pushing for a truce on the model of the 2012 truce, which is hardly surprising, because I think that the whole sort of the most depressing thing perhaps about this conflict is that it's so not new. It's the third siege of Gaza that we've seen since 2008. It seems as if both sides are just rehearsing the same moves again and again and again. And so while a truce on that sort of model might be perhaps the only way to get a sort of temporary ceasefire, you sort of wonder how long that will hold for. And I think the other thing is that the stakes are so high for both sides at this point. I mean, since Egypt put their proposal on the table a week and a half ago, a lot's changed, and Israel staked a lot on their ground offensive there, and Hamas sort of, I think, feels they need to show something for the huge loss of civilian life. And so I think both sides will be quite reluctant to lay down their arms without securing something first.
I think there's one really large difference between 2012 and right now, and that is who is ruling Egypt. And that makes any ceasefire along any lines significantly more difficult. In 2012, you had Mohamed Morsi of the Muslim Brotherhood was the president of Egypt. And they have, obviously, they have relations with Hamas. Hamas is the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood, although the Egyptian, the Palestinian versions are significantly different. And, you know, that's a kind of helpful entity rather than what you have now, where Hamas feels that, and in this case quite legitimately feels that both Field Marshal Sisi, President Sisi, the new strongman of Egypt, and also John Kerry, the Secretary of State of the US are basically very negatively disposed towards Hamas, which makes coming to any sort of deal or them really thinking that any deal is legitimate coming from those two brokers, it makes it very challenging.
I'll ask you a bit more about that in a moment. Let's just listen to this short clip from one of our Cairo-based contributors, Abdul Rahman Hussein, who delves into exactly those origins, James, of Sisi and Egypt's broader hostility towards Hamas. Let's hear what he had to say.
In autumn 2012, 16 Egyptian soldiers on the border with Gaza were murdered as they sat down to break their fast during the month of Ramadan. The culprits were never identified, but the popular consensus was that Hamas was behind it. This anti-Hamas sentiment intensified and eventually began to include Palestinians and the Palestinian cause. An anonymous member of the Egyptian armed forces told Reuters at the time that the military had decided, after removing the Muslim Brotherhood, Hamas was next. Egyptian attempts to mediate a ceasefire have also been taken within this paradigm, where now Hamas does not see it as an impartial arbiter to the conflict. And while US Secretary of State John Kerry continues to shuttle to Cairo to meet Sisi for even more attempts at some sort of truce, the view from Egypt seems to be not wholly uncomfortable with current Israeli operations in the Strip.
It is an interesting dynamic, isn't it, James? A lot of observers from this, from the outside are looking at Kerry as this sort of key actor, but there's very much a sense that actually Sisi is calling the shots. It's Sisi and not the White House who are sort of in charge of the momentum here. Do you find it problematic to even view Sisi in any way as this sort of neutral arbiter? He's being presented almost as a potential kind of broker of this deal. And from what you said before and the insights there of Abdul Rahman Hussein, that's a bit of a joke, that idea, isn't it?
It is a complete joke. The idea that Sisi can be viewed in any way as a neutral arbiter is a complete non-starter. And also, you're right that the Egyptian role in this particular crisis, or at least in the build-up to this crisis, is significant. After Sisi came to power in the middle of last year, there was a shutting down of the border crossings and a much, as we're hearing, aggressive stance towards Hamas-run Gaza Strip. And in some ways, you can see part of the motivation for Hamas trying to have the unity government with Fatah as trying to reopen that Rafah crossing, because that was the only way they could get Egypt to do so. Part of the agreement was that there would be Fatah, Palestinian Authority figures controlling the crossing rather than Hamas figures. And Egypt haven't done that. So Egypt really are a large contributing factor to the building up of pressure and the kind of terrible blockade of Gaza, which has been ongoing for some time and is really a key driver of the current conflict.
And Samira, I just wonder, there's suggestions that Egypt might consider sort of tweaking some of the details of the proposals that we've seen in the last couple of weeks. They were rejected, of course, by Hamas. I guess interesting to speculate about what those tweaks might be. Is there a more fundamental problem, do you think, that perhaps given that Sisi and his cronies essentially arrived in power by means of a coup, it's pretty difficult to establish any kind of legitimacy in any sorts of discussions when that's your own background, isn't it?
Well, I suppose the argument of his camp would be that they've since won an election. But I think that it will be interesting to see what changes in the deal. As James was saying, you know, I think it's very difficult to separate any potential deal that's agreed in Gaza from the sort of domestic political context of Egypt, which is that there is this increasing anti-Palestinian feeling, where there's sort of people will be very reluctant to open that Rafah border. And actually what Egypt's proposed is simply to sort of lay down arms and sort out the details later. And Hamas doesn't want to do that without a sort of getting something first. So I think it's very difficult. And I mean, Egypt's always occupied a slightly complicated position when it comes to negotiations between Israel and Palestine. It's played a key role, but you know, Egypt and Israel have been sort of unofficial allies for years and years under Mubarak, and so it is a complicated role. I think, given the current context, this incredibly polarized Egypt, this sort of hatred growing amongst the public and certainly among the authorities of any movement even vaguely affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood, I think that will make it very difficult.
I think it's going to be really interesting to see how the Egyptian population starts to push on Sisi, because, you know, throughout the period, exactly as Samira says, where you've got a kind of weird semi-alliance between Egypt and Israel, the population has generally been pro-Palestinian and continues to be very, you know, strongly anti-Israel in principle, they may not, sections of the population may not like the Muslim Brotherhood, but that doesn't mean that they are anti-Palestinian in any way. And it'll be interesting. I mean, Sisi doesn't have an easy hand to play. I mean, he's got to, from, you know, his own strategic interests, he's got to keep up things very, very tough on Hamas whilst not seeming too much like a kind of puppet of Israel, because that does not play well at all domestically in Egyptian politics.
One final thought then, I guess, on this. James, do you think that Netanyahu is going to stick with the existing plan, try and sort of rid Israel of the threat of Hamas permanently? Or do you think there could be some kind of deal brokered, particularly, as I said, additional pressures on the US now, once they get hit in the pocket and they're not going to like these airlines not being able to fly in? Does that sort of up the stakes, raise the ante a little on them? Or do you think that Netanyahu will, you know, stick literally and metaphorically to his guns? What's your take on it?
Well, Zippy Livni, the justice minister and former prime minister of Israel, said that they're too far apart to see any ceasefire in the very near future. And you're right that the US should be able to twist the arms of Israel and Egypt and say, come on, get to it. I mean, after all, they provide an enormous amount of weaponry and moral and political support for both leaderships. Kerry has said that basically everything Israel is doing in Gaza is all good and proper, thumbs up, nice one, guys. And also he said that, you know, Sisi's coup is effectively legitimate. He said it was saving democracy, it saved the revolution, and he's given them complete support and, you know, Apache helicopters again. So you would have thought that America would have some leverage. But I think, as there is the case in many other places where security or questions of supposedly terrorism are involved, the tail wags the dog much more than the dog wags the tail.
Indeed. Let's stay in the region now and take a brief look at Syria, where the now three-year-old civil war may have stopped making the headlines, but continues to be as bloody as ever as Bashar al-Assad's forces battle Islamist militants. ISIS, which now refers to itself as the Islamic State, took control of a gas field in the desert east of the city of Homs at the weekend. Subsequent fighting left more than 700 dead, according to the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights. It's called the violence the worst since the uprising began. The incidents have raised fresh concerns about the Islamic State's ongoing march broadly throughout the region. Samira, we haven't really heard as much about Syria. Is it just one of these things that's drifted off the radar somewhat because of events, of course, in Gaza, other instances, of course, happening in the east of Ukraine, of course? Is that why it's slightly drifted perhaps out of the Western media conscience?
I think it is a bit. I mean, there is a sort of quite well-documented phenomenon of war fatigue, that if there isn't something sort of significantly new, just continuing conflict and bloodshed in place isn't sadly enough to keep it at the top of the news agendas. I think it's sort of judged by editors and publics alike that it's not sort of front page news anymore, which is a shame, I think, because it sort of removes the political pressure to push for a diplomatic situation solution and so on. I think it's also quite interesting that as you say, so much of the attention because of the sort of ISIS sweep of Iraq switched to Iraq, when in fact that's very much a problem that affects both Iraq and Syria. Certainly, ISIS made huge gains of land in Iraq, but that doesn't mean they've stopped seizing huge swathes of land in Syria. And I think perhaps in addition to that sort of war fatigue, media priorities shifting, there's also the fact that it's quite a complicated issue for Western leaders. So I don't think you've got people sort of making bold statements about what should happen there in the way that we did perhaps 2 years ago, even maybe 1 year ago. And I think that's to do with the fact that it's getting more and more complicated all the time. There's this anxiety about having called for Assad to go. There's this anxiety now, I think, in the White House in Downing Street about what would actually happen if he were to go, now that you have this ISIS threat. And I think that's why we're not talking now about what should happen in the Syrian civil war. We're talking about sort of what kind of effect ISIS could have on the West. And so there's that real sort of shift of emphasis there.
I wonder then, just on that point, do you think that sort of war fatigue presents a bit of an opportunity almost to Assad, and indeed, I guess, the Islamic State on the other hand? They can take advantage of that feeling of sort of ennui in the West. Or do you think that, counter to that, maybe Bashar al-Assad will be feeling regret, I guess, that he's let this situation sort of spiral out of control somewhat?
I don't think he'll be feeling regret. I think he'll probably be feeling quite smug that, first of all, they've made big battlefield gains even before ISIS took over so much land. And that's partly because ISIS has sort of split the rebel groups. So sort of you've got rebels fighting a mini civil war amongst themselves on top of the other civil war. So I think Assad certainly feels like he's in a winning position, and I think probably feels quite vindicated by the fact that Western leaders are now not so strongly calling for him to go and not taking steps to pressurise a negotiated settlement anymore. And so I think it probably, if anything, enforces the feeling of Assad and his regime that they should, that it was the right thing to do to sort of sit tight and hang on and wait to win.
Those are the insights of Samira Shackle, James Schneider alongside us here as well on Midori House. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll turn our attention to developments in Africa. Stay tuned.
What designs will you be wearing next season? How will architecture change the face of your city? And which redesign will affect the paper you pick up?
It's very strange. It's like two triangles and two squares more. But I think that's a stimulus for the architect.
The kerning can take 5 times as long as actually designing the letter forms, which seems fairly brutal.
Is it going to perform? Is it going to stay the same? Is it going to be the same? That's normal anxiety.
Good design improves our lives. If you want to find out how, join me, Monocle's design editor Tom Morris, every Tuesday on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards, 1821 in London. Still with me in Studio One here at Midori House are both Samira Shackle and James Schneider. We're going to look now to South Sudan, which has seen violent fighting over the past couple of days, and where the UN is now warning there could soon be a famine, as we were hearing in the news at the top of the programme. South Sudan declared its independence from the north just 3 years ago and was originally considered something of a success story. But divisions between President Kiir, who's from one tribe, and his now ex-deputy Riek Machar, who's from another, have essentially split Africa's newest country along ethnic lines. Fighting erupted last year, and since then, more than 1.5 million people have been displaced. A ceasefire was agreed in May but hasn't held. In the latest incident, rebel leaders claim to have taken control of the city of Nasir, where they've been fighting government forces. James, perhaps if I can start with you, how would you characterise the changes then we've seen in recent months? Is there any suggestion then, given these problems, that there's any sort of functioning government or governance at all within South Sudan?
No, there isn't really. There have been these ongoing dancing around set of negotiations. They're meant to come to a conclusion towards the end of this month, and they're meant to come up with some kind of national unity government. But clearly those negotiations are taking place a very long way. I mean, both geographically, they're taking place in Addis Ababa, but also in effect from the battlefield, where fighting does still continue. There's been breaking of the ceasefire on both sides at different points. Both sides claim whenever they break the ceasefire that the other side started it, and there is at this stage, I mean, the real problem is that the leaders of each respective group, one, don't have total control over all of the forces that are fighting in their name, which is pretty problematic when they're trying to keep any ceasefire at bay. But also they have so much blood on their hands over the last more than 20 years. I mean, Nasser, the town that was taken, was the site of Riek Machar effectively starting the civil war within South Sudan during the greater civil war within Sudan by forming his own rival faction, which was mainly Nuer of the independent struggle army. And so, I mean, these two figures, Salva Kiir and Riek Machar, are pretty incapable at this stage of forming some kind of, you know, grand coalition government that could manage it in some way and bring peace, because they don't trust each other. They don't trust each other at all. And that distrust is becoming more and more ethnicised the longer it goes on.
And what about the United Nations? Because at the end of last year, the UN agreed to send increased numbers of peacekeeping troops to more than 5,000, I think, to the region. Only half of those arrived. Is it a mistake, or is it short-sighted or simplistic to look to the UN to try and unpick these very deep-seated divisions that we're seeing here?
I mean, I don't think it's misguided to look to the UN, but I think it's misguided to think that the UN can just come in and solve everything, or that it is, has the capacity to do so. I mean, if you look at neighbouring Central African Republic as well, where there is another ongoing crisis which tends to not get that much coverage, like that in South Sudan, the UN is meant to be providing troops. It announces troops. They are always slow in coming. Member countries are very slow in paying the money for both humanitarian access and just stumping up the troop numbers. And that's the and that's the problem. It's not a kind of organizational problem with the UN that they are unable to do something. The regional body, IGAD, has a very large role to play, as does the African Union, in hitting the heads of the leaders together. But I also think it is imperative that they say they can't be involved in whatever the next government is. Mm. That's got to be the price to pay for having, almost completely torn their country apart.
And Samira, just on this point, is this one of those classic questions where, people from the West, again, some of these other actors that James described there, say, this is an internal African conflict, let's leave them to it, sort it out? I mean, do you think there's a failure from the wider international community to get involved and sort of grasp the nettle?
It's always a really complicated question, I think, and it's often quite it differs hugely from country to country, the sort of question of how best to provide international support, where that international support should come from, whether it should be African Union or from the West, etc., etc. I think certainly in the case of South Sudan, you can't really leave them to it, just partly because it's so new and there just isn't any sort of infrastructure there. I think that you kind of can't really leave that without some sort of support for state building if you want it to have any hope of being a viable state in the future. And I think this sort of cycle of violence probably... sort of my reading of it is that it reflects the sort of violence that the state was born out of, I think, and it's you can't really expect that you form the new state and it'll all be peaceful and it'll be great. I mean, it's a cycle that we've seen over decades in Sudan, where you have and elsewhere in Africa certainly, where you have sort of temporary peace agreements signed that actually ends up just being a sort of chance for different factions and groups to rearm and rest up a bit, and then it springs up again. So I think it's a sort of continuation of that.
Well, let's look at another example in Africa. Let's cross to Nigeria, where President Goodluck Jonathan has been meeting with some of the parents of a group of girls who were kidnapped by the Islamist group Boko Haram back in April now. It's the first time the president has agreed to talk face-to-face with the victims' families. A meeting last week was cancelled by the parents, who suggested it was a stage for political benefit, and he's faced a great deal of pressure to do so since, let's remember the numbers, more than 200 teenagers were seized in the Borno region of northern Nigeria. At least 11 of the parents are known to have died since the mass abduction. Their families claim that the stress of living under this sort of siege mentality was to blame in that. Boko Haram has agreed to free some of the girls in response for the release of fighters, its fighters being held by the government. The proposal has been rejected thus far. Why do you think, Samira, that he's agreed to do this now? Is it just cumulative pressure from the international community, from these families, perhaps finally from within his own administration?
I mean, I don't think he could have put off meeting them forever, but it is, the fact that it's 100 days later sort of beggars belief, I think. Mm. If you imagine that in any other country, really, that this is already a region where people are very disenfranchised, a huge part of the reason that Boko Haram's been able to make the kind of foothold it has is because people feel so alienated and abandoned by the central government. It's a really poor region. It's a region where the security services and security forces, rather, haven't been doing as much as they should to stem the insurgency for the years and years in which it was growing. And so to sort of on top of that not have the head of state not making the trip to sort of just reassure people, I think, is sort of really underlines all those problems.
He's kind of lurched from one PR disaster in handling this, James, to another, hasn't he? Why do you think it's been so poorly managed by him and his administration? Do you think there was a failure to look without, also to get assistance perhaps from his neighbours? I mean, Where does the fault? Is it a personal culpability? Is it with his advisors? Where does the fault in what has clearly been terribly handled from the outset rest?
On the PR side, there is rank incompetence on his part and on the part of his two senior advisors and spokesmen, Doina Coupe and Ruben Abati. But also, he's now finally gone and paid $1.2 million, I think it is, for reputation management to a company called Levick, who are a US PR company. And they don't seem to be doing a very good job either, because they've become part of the story. And Nigerian activists are very, very angry that this, you know, government money is being spent to basically massage Jonathan's image. But there is a deeper political point to this as well, beyond just pure incompetence, which is good luck, Jonathan, and the coterie around him sort of don't view Boko Haram as a thing in itself. They think Boko Haram is a representation of a political opposition to him. And they think that the Bring Back Our Girls movement and all those who are campaigning are funded by the opposition, are opposition elements, and the whole thing is political to undermine him. So he can't give any ground. He did the same thing with the Occupy Nigeria protests in early 2012, where he said that they were all funded by the opposition. The, you know, millions of people protesting the streets was all apparently paid for by the opposition, which is nonsense. And so he has failed to grasp what it is, because he's interpreting everything in very narrow political terms.
And there we must leave it. James Schneider and Samira Shackle, thank you both very much indeed, as always, for joining us here on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette Monaco 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. See on Monaco 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monaco 24 des.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monaco 24.
18:31 here in London. There's plenty still to come in the second half of today's Midori House. We'll head to Madrid for a catch-up with our correspondent and hear from a DJ who's getting his crowd to move a little more slowly. But before we get started on all that, let's hear from Paul Osborne, who's got the latest world news headlines.
A renewed diplomatic effort is underway to try to end the violence in Gaza. The US Secretary of State John Kerry has been discussing a possible peace plan with Egypt, while the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon's met Israel's Prime Minister. He told both sides to stop fighting and start talking. Meanwhile, in the United States, the FAA has told airlines to halt flights to Israel for at least the next 24 hours after reports of rocket fire near the airport in Tel Aviv. The victims of the plane crash over Ukraine have now been removed from rebel-held territory. The remains of those killed in the loss of Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 are to be flown to the Netherlands. Russia is continuing to dismiss Western claims that the plane was shot down by rebels. European Union foreign ministers have been discussing new sanctions against Moscow. Joko Widodo will be the next president of Indonesia after official results from elections showed he won 53% of the vote. His rival, the former general Prabowo Subianto, had threatened to challenge that result, but now says he accepts he's been defeated. And the widow of the Russian dissident, Alexander Litvinenko, says she is delighted by news that the British government will stage a public inquiry into his death. He died in 2006 in a hospital in London after being poisoned with the radioactive element polonium. And the inquiry will look at claims that Russia was involved in his death. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much indeed, Paul. More news from Paul Osborne at the top of the hour. That'll be 1900, of course, here in London, 1500 in Rio. You're listening to Midori House, and it's time to check in with one of our many correspondents around the world. Today, we're speaking to our Madrid correspondent, Liam Aldous, who's actually in Portugal at the moment. Liam, great to speak with you, as always. Let's start in Madrid, your usual haunt, and one of the most famous haunts in that city, the Prado Museum. What have they been up to? I gather they may have misplaced some masterpieces. Can this be true?
Apparently it is true, and they haven't just misplaced a few. A report came out recently that's showing that they've actually misplaced 885 pieces of art. So this is a bit of a scandal, and basically it seems like Spain's audit court is on a bit of a hunt. He wants to know where, the person in charge wants to know where they've gone and basically what's happened to them, because this isn't necessarily an isolated incident, because there was a report recently that Madrid City Hall actually lost misplaced, as they put it, 200 artworks. So it's a bit of a problem plaguing the Spanish capital at the moment. And the Prado spokeswoman came out and said that, it's not actually that much of a big deal. Like, most of them, she said, were lost in fires or even wars. So the problem is, because there's no evidence to actually support how they were misplaced, they haven't been removed from the inventory. So she's basically blaming it on a bit of a bad paper trail.
That's extraordinary. I just wonder, I mean, are there plans afoot at least then to try and catalogue all of this stuff in a more thorough and robust way? Because not even knowing what you've lost sounds to me like a pretty serious problem for an established and esteemed international museum.
It is definitely a problem. A lot of people are talking about the fact that the Prado Museum and also the Reina Sofia and other museums across Spain have been faced with massive budget cuts, and they're struggling to kind of keep up with basically the logistical challenge of running a museum. It's not an easy job, but there is a plan afoot to catalogue the works a lot better and photograph the works and keep track of all the artworks that go out to various museums across Spain and also across the world. There was, in 2012, there was something like 33 foreign shows and 288 pieces were lent out to foreign museums. So they're saying that they're trying to get on top of this, but the problem is they're lacking staff and money to kind of track all these artworks. So we'll see if they turn up. Maybe they'll turn up in someone's house. Who knows?
Hope you don't have any of them squirreled away, Liam. Now, another financial worry. Financial issue, I guess, that's dominating some of the discourse in Madrid is about, one of the universities there wanting to charge the church rent. Now, that's not going to be very popular, is it, over in Spain, I imagine?
Well, it's definitely not popular with the Catholic Church. They've come out fighting, basically. There's been some incredible scenes inside the Complutense University in Madrid of priests staging masses and confessionary kind of sittings in the corridors in their kind of very kind of particularly Catholic way of protesting, and they're not very happy because this is a long-running issue. It's been running since 2013, actually, when the university has to kind of reassess the agreement it has with the Catholic Church as to what facilities they're allowed to use, and the Complutense University has 8 chapels or rooms they use as chapels on campus, and the dean of the university is saying it's not fair that they should actually either consolidate their space on campus or pay. And there's been some figures thrown around saying that they should pay about 5,000 euros a year or even as low as 160 euros a year. But they're not happy. The Catholics aren't happy. And there's been reports saying that the people protesting in the corridors aren't actually from the university. They've actually brought in a lot of people, taken them off the pews in various churches around Madrid and sent them to the corridors of the universities. And the dean says this is quite incredible, saying that there's actually only about 5 people, or between 5 and 20 people, that attend these masses each day. So it's a bit of an ongoing dispute, but it doesn't look like it's going to come down anytime soon.
Indeed. Liam, let's talk about, some box office successes then. After all of these financial worries, we've got a hit that's really generating big bucks at the box office. I believe now the biggest ever homegrown hit for Spain. Remind us what it is and tell us why you think it's been doing so well.
Well, it's Ocho Apellidos Vascos, which means 8 bar surnames. It actually came out quite a few months ago in March. It's actually earned about 46 million euros at the box office. But a recent article in El País showed that the success it's had at the box office, basically it's a rom-com. It's a comedy that plays on Basque stereotypes and Andalusian stereotypes, and it's been incredibly successful. But it's had a big impact on Basque tourism, and the article kind of explains how Spaniards have had a lot of kind of... There's been a lot of stigma about going to the Basque country, obviously because of the past history with terrorism, but also because... this stereotype goes that if you're from Madrid or if you're from elsewhere in Spain, Basques aren't necessarily very, very welcoming. And there's a joke in the movie how they traditionally key the cars of cars that have number plates from outside of the Basque country. But I mean, my personal experience hasn't been so. I find the Basque incredibly welcoming. I find the region incredibly beautiful, and I think the movies helped the rest of Spain discover that as well. And a lot of people are going there, and particularly the locations where the movie was filmed have seen a huge upsurge in tourist numbers, and the Spaniards are rediscovering a very beautiful region in their own country.
Wonderful stuff, Liam. Thanks as always. That's our Madrid correspondent, Liam Aldous, talking to us on Midori House. Liam, thanks very much. We'll be back as the show continues here on Monocle 24 right after this.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. Time for a little culture now. We bring you one man's attempt to tell an alternative history of the United States. Forget Columbus, the author Ilan Stavan says, abandoning the narratives of dead white men in favour of a focus on immigrants and workers, housewives and slaves. A Most Imperfect Union, which is the book's title, is a mishmash of events from the arrival of European settlers right up to the shooting of black teenager Trayvon Martin, all attempting to give a voice to the dispossessed. I'm delighted to say I'm joined on the line now by Ilan from his home in Massachusetts. Ilan, welcome to the programme. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Now, let me just ask you first of all about actually tackling a book of this scale in a sort of comic book form, really, if you like, because people will be familiar with comic books, this balance of the pictures and the prose. The pictures tend to sort of almost dominate the form. That's not really the balance here. Tell me a little bit about the relationship with your illustrator, Lalo Alcaraz, how you work together to get the balance just right.
Lalo is a syndicated cartoonist that works in Los Angeles, very popular, very irreverent. He and I have been collaborating for a number of years, maybe 15. We did together a book in the year 2000 called Latino USA, a history of the Hispanic population in this country that became surprisingly very, very popular, being adopted for courses and so on. And 15 years later, we decided to do something more epic, more ambitious. The relationship is one mostly done by email, fax, phone. I plan how every single page should look like. Lalo executes it, and in that dialogue back and forth, we change, we transform until the page looks the way we both want to.
It's very modest of you to say what a surprise it was that your last effort did so well, I think, Ilan. Tell me a little bit about then your own approach, because it strikes me reading the book that actually it owes in many ways a lot more to almost the sort of political cartoon than to the sort of comic book. Are you sort of acutely aware of both of those twin influences then on your work?
I am. I am an immigrant from Mexico to the United States. I grew up with a very visual culture in the 1960s and 70s. Most of us young kids in Mexico did not read novels, but read comic strips, some foreign, many of them domestic, and we fell in love with that type of culture. It's a very Mexican mishmash because it mixes elements from pre-Columbian artifacts to something that comes from Europe or the United States, or that came at that time from then. I tried in this book to replicate that kind of balance or lack thereof. The idea is that most Americans today get their news from comedy channels, and that they themselves are very, they don't take them very seriously. And I wanted to use humor, I wanted to use comedy to look at American history in a way that I don't think that historians are doing it in the United States today. We get a very triumphant, very, very patriotic history in this country, and the hope was to present an alternative one.
Well, tell me a bit more about that, because it's very arresting that there is this focus on the differing heritage of people, the heritage of this country, and also this almost twin history. There's almost the history that's written by the insiders and the history penned and often untold by the outsiders. Were you very aware of wanting to reflect more of that, if you like, true history of the US when you set out writing the book?
Absolutely. My hope was to somehow take history away from historians and bring it back to the rest of us, to the people. I'm not a historian. I don't pretend to be one. But I don't think history should be the property of historians alone. I think the people in a country that purports to be democratic, the people are the ones in charge of it. Very seldom do you get a history in the United States that is told from the immigrant's point of view. This country has been changing dramatically after 1950. Prior to that year, most immigrants came from Europe, with the exception of African slaves. After 1950, they come from all over the world, and yet in textbooks, in official histories, you still get very much the white European version of events. And I think it is time to get a very different sense of who we are, a much more complex mosaic of people from Southeast Asia, from Latin America, from the French and Spanish Caribbean. And that's what I tried to do in an irreverent way in this book, A Most Imperfect Union.
Well, I just wonder then, as time passes and as that population balance in the US shifts ever more, is this a sort of book that you'll need to sort of be constantly revisiting and refreshing as even the population balance of the country changes? Because we're going to see, you know, arguably a white minority, what, within maybe a generation or so. Do you think that the book will be a kind of a record of that shift, or will you need to keep revisiting it and changing it as those populations shift?
I hope that the book becomes a portal to those transformations. Latino USA, the book that I was mentioning before, published 15 years ago, was recently updated with two new chapters reflecting how Latinos have now become majorities in cities like San Antonio and Houston and Miami. And I hope that in 5 years, 10 years, A Most Imperfect Union would also need a new chapter or more that shows that the whites are now, by then, a minority, and that the different minorities have become the majority, but none of them really becoming one that colors the entire country. I think we're moving in a direction where there will be no single color at the top, but a rotation, a kind of kaleidoscopic transition, cyclical, constantly.
Ilan Stavans, creator, along with illustrator Lalo Alcaraz, of A Most Imperfect Union, A Contrarian History of the United States. Thank you very much indeed for joining us on Midori House. And that book is out now by Basic Books. You should get hold of a copy if you can. You're with Midori House here on Monocle 24. Time to review the best of television, cinema, theatre, books. Today is Tuesday, which means we're getting a little musical. Bill Brewster is known as the DJ's DJ. He's co-author of the definitive tome on the history of the DJ and his or her role in music culture. He runs the highly regarded music website DJHistory.com and is well known for his mix compilations, the latest one being Late Night Tales Presents Night Shift, where the beats per minute drop to a more leisurely pace and the focus turns from the dance floor to the after party. He sat down with Monocle's resident music boffin, Paul Noble, to talk tempos and turntables.
Bill Brewster, welcome back into Monocle. And we're here to talk about your new album, After Dark to Night Shift. So this is not the sort of intense banging end of the club spectrum. This is the more mellow side of things.
Yeah, the idea was to produce compilations that were kind of aimed at the sort of slower tempo but still dance floor friendly. So the idea is music from anywhere from about 90 BPM up to about 115 BPM. So the kind of limit of anything that we've included on the album is 115 BPM, whereas most house records start around 118, 119 onwards. So the idea is kind of, I suppose, to create an atmosphere with music that would be played somewhere beyond 2 a.m. in the morning.
And so as someone who's, you know, well-versed in the dynamics of the dance floor and looking how to read a crowd and when's the right time to play the right record, with stuff this slow, is that a gamble when you put that on?
it's not a gamble, but I think you have to lead people there by the hand because, you know, when people are kind of used to hearing music at a particular tempo, if you just suddenly stop it and change to a much slower tempo, people will notice and you do get people coming up and saying, you know, can you switch it up a bit, mate?
Yeah. Worried looks from promoters.
Exactly. Yeah. What I tended to do is just kind of, when it gets to that time of the night, I just gradually kind of put the brakes on slightly so people don't notice it's happening. And by the time you get down to 110, 105 BPM, they've scarcely even noticed that you've sort of changed gear.
And then you can effortlessly slip into your funk selection.
Absolutely. That's absolutely it.
All right. Let's start off with a track from the album. This is Day Outside. Who are or is Day Outside?
Day Outside is the alter ego of a guy called Fernando Pulicino, who's an Argentinian based in Buenos Aires. But he lived over in the UK for quite a long time and played bass in the 2020 sound system. He's one half of Silver City with another Argentinian producer. He's a really, really great bass player and also a really good musician. He's done this album of him singing and producing, of which this is the only track that's so far come out, but the whole album is ready to go, and I'm a big fan of what he does.
So some groovy stuff from South America there. When you're putting together a compilation, how do you start? Is it a mood in your head, or is there a long list of tracks which you know you'll be able to license?
You start off in a fairly random fashion with maybe a list of 30 to 40 tracks that you'd like to include. And then once you start receiving clearances, in other words, from the 40, it might get whittled down to 20. It might be even less, actually. Then you start shaping how you think the compilation will work. And so you effectively have two or three sort of periods. The first one is just literally lumping a load of stuff into an Excel spreadsheet to see what happens. And once you get, say, 12 or 15 clearances, then you start kind of actually shaping the compilation in your head and then adding things and actually taking away things that have been cleared because they don't really work with other songs. So it's a sort of gradual process. So we're doing another one next year, which will come out around the same time next year, but we're already starting to do the work for it now. So it is quite a lengthy process. It probably takes about 6 months of licensing before you actually get a finished compilation that you can mix.
And as someone who's had a long career in dance music at Mixmag and various record labels, is the compilation CD still a sort of viable product? We know vinyl's on the up, and obviously downloads and streaming are huge. Do people go and buy CDs and listen to them in their entirety?
They do. Yeah, they do. I mean, they certainly don't buy them in the numbers that they did in the early 1990s. I mean, you know, a really good selling specialist dance music CD in the early 90s could sell 35,000 copies, whereas now you're talking between 5 and 10,000 copies. So it obviously has It's got much smaller, but there are people that do it. And I think the way that labels that are doing well are surviving is by offering, for example, on a mix CD, you get a download code so you can download the individual tracks for free. With the vinyl, most record companies offering vinyl these days will also offer a free download code so you can have MP3s of the tracks on iTunes as well. So there are ways around it. I think they've definitely made it a more attractive product for people.
Right. Let's move on to some more music. This isn't on the compilation album. This is the very biblical sounding Bob Moses. Who is Bob?
Well, I don't know whether Bob Moses exists as a person. I don't know much about them, but I do know it's a duo from Brooklyn. And I don't know if one of them's called Bob Moses or whether Bob Moses is a fictitious name that they've employed. But they put out a single last year on a really little label that was really good. Great, great song. And this one has been picked up by Domino. So I'm assuming that maybe they've got an album deal coming with Domino, although I don't actually know that for sure. But the fact they've released a single on Domino suggests that there's more to come. But they're very talented, really good songwriters. And it's got a very kind of bluesy feel, this track.
All right, this is I Ain't Gonna Be the First to Cry.
Laugh on me. I ain't gonna be the first to cry. Even though you had the last laugh on me, you're just a link in my chain. Someone else will end this misery. I ain't gonna be the lonely one. Someone will chase the clouds away.
Definite Chris Isaak kind of smoky vibe on that one.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of, it's almost quite old fashioned, even though they're using electronic music. A lot of the ideas in it are very old.
That is very nice. Let's move on swiftly to Calabrese, a track called Independent Dancer.
Okay, Calabrese is someone that I've been a fan of for several years, but I never really knew very much about him. But I got booked to play in a club in Zurich called Zukunft, which is an unusual club because it was bought and is run by local DJs. They bought the space and they run it as a collective. And I did a party there one Thursday night with a guy called DJ Lex, and there was this mad guy kept getting on the microphone and sort of emceeing the night and generally acting in a very funny but very drunk way, and it turned out this was Calabrese. So
thought everyone was so well behaved in Zurich.
No, not at all. So I was already a fan of his stuff, and just once I met him, he's such a kind of local character and obviously very popular there. People were cheering when he got on the mic, and he sings on his records as well. He's not technically a great singer, but I just love the kind of feel of what he does. They're quite weird records, a lot of them. The track we're going to play is slightly more orthodox, but a lot of them are very odd, but in an interesting way, I think. Kind of a bit Robert Wyatt sounding.
Definitely hear the Robert Wyatt thing and a bit of David Byrne.
David Byrne, most definitely, yeah.
That's the Calabrese from Zurich, the wild man of Zurich. Watch out for him when you're on your travels. We're going to finish up with one more track from After Dark 2, Night Shift, and this is the fantastically named Hubba Bubba Club,
yeah. I bought this on a 7-inch about a year and a half ago, and I've been playing it incessantly ever since. It's kind of... I've turned it into a bit of an anthem at our party, Low Life, which is odd because it's actually sung in Norwegian. But it's about, it's called Moped Bart, and Moped Bart is the Norwegian equivalent of bum fluff. What it literally means is moped mustache, and it's about all of those 16-year-old boys thinking they're really cool with their bum fluff riding about on mopeds in Oslo. And I got the guy that wrote the song to translate it for me just so I could, you know, have a sense of what he was singing about. But it's a tune that I absolutely adore. It's got great lyrics, even though they're in Norwegian.
Well, it sounds like a shoo-in for the Monocle 24 playlist.
Absolutely.
Bill Brewster, thank you very much for coming in, and we're going to end on Hubba Bubba Club.
Yeah, sure, hey. Jeg hakker klokke på. Ingen steder jeg må gå. Jeg kjører høy.
And Bill Brewster's latest compilation, Late Night Tales Presents After Dark Night Shift, is out now. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Samira Shackle and James Schneider. Today's show is produced by Marika Peters, research by Matilda Ivy and Fernando Pacheco. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. Plenty still to come, so check out the Monocle Daily at 2200 hours. This show, though, will be back at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 hours, of course, London time. But for this edition of Midori House and me, Tom Edwards, it's goodbye. Thank you very much indeed for tuning in.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world famous, Oyster perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.